Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
Welcome to Crosspoint.
We are an inclusive faith community
seeking to live out the loving, just, and generous way of Jesus.
We are participants in a long tradition
that's less concerned with doctrines and dogma that demand total agreement,
but a life to be lived, enjoyed, and given away to others.
What unites us is a growing awareness that life is precious,
that we are made by love in order to love.
This community is comprised of and affirms the entire human family,
regardless of race, age, creed,
physical abilities, marital or economic status,
gender identity, or sexual orientation.
So, if you are curious and have come to see,
if you are tired and have come to rest,
if you are grateful and have come to share,
if you are wounded and have come to heal,
if you are joyful and have come to celebrate,
if you are uprooted and have come to belong,
welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Welcome home.
Happy New Year. Let's talk a little bit about how we move into the future with a mindfulness of how we've walked through everything in our past. I want to do so today using a couple of really old stories from the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible. And I want to say from the outset, I know this is not going to be for everyone, but it might be for you later. So maybe store it away for yourself, or maybe it'll prove to be for somebody you know, and this will help you be helpful to them. Also, I'm not trying to say everything on these themes today. I'm speaking sort of broadly, culturally, because it's going to matter. It does matter on that level. But then more precisely, I want to speak to individuals who whoever you are that this turns out to be for. Okay? All right, enough preamble. Moses has only recently led the enslaved Israelites out of Egypt, where obviously things had been awful for a long time. But now they're out of slavery, and just a few months later, things are awful again. And Exodus 17 reads, "The people thirsted there for water, and the people complained against Moses and said, 'Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?'" In the previous chapter, 16, they had just said, "We are so hungry, you know, this sucks. I wish we had died as slaves back in Egypt, because at least there we had meat and bread." And I get that. I bet you do too. Like when you go from one place in your life to another, work or relationships, and you get out across a line, you were so eager and excited to cross. But now that you're out there, you look back and you're like, you know, things did suck back then, but it was a familiar suck. I don't know about that. I want this anymore. So Moses cried out to the Lord, "What shall I do for this people? They're ready to kill me." And the Lord said to Moses, "Go on ahead of the people and take some of the elders of Israel with you. Take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. I'll be standing there in front of you on the rock at Horeb. Strike the rock and water will come out of it so that the people may drink." Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So Moses goes up to this rock in the wilderness and hits this rock with a stick, and water starts gushing out of it, and everybody and their livestock has water. Huge relief. It's just what they needed. Now, time passes. Way more time than people anticipate. It's four decades later, and they're still not to the promised land. In fact, most of the original people who started this journey, they're dead. An entire generation has passed. But there is a real sense later on in the book of Numbers that the promised land is, this is finally going to happen. And so Numbers chapter 20 reads, "There was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and against his brother Aaron. The people quarreled with Moses and said, 'Would that we had died when our kindred died before. Like, I wish we had just died when our parents died. Why have you brought the assembly of the Lord into this wilderness for us and our livestock to die here? Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to bring us to this wretched place? It's no place for grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink.'" This should sound really familiar. "Then Moses and Aaron went away from the assembly to the entrance of the tent of meeting. They fell on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'Take the staff and assemble the congregation, you and your brother Aaron, and command the rock before their eyes to yield its water. Thus you shall bring water out of the rock for them. Thus you shall provide drink for the congregation and their livestock. So Moses took the staff from before the Lord, as he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, "Listen, you rebels." You can hear the exhaustion in his voice, like he's just over it. The word rebels in Hebrew here is mara, which means antagonist or bitter. It's the same root word for grief, same root word for the name Mary. A little bit of useful trivia for you. "Listen up, you difficult, embittering jerks. Shall we bring water for you? You want some water from this rock?" Then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his staff, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you didn't trust me to show my holiness before the eyes of the Israelites, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land that I have given them." Moses, after all these years, you're not going. But Moses makes water come out of the rock. But no promised land for some reason. And I hope you're thinking in metaphors like we sort of naturally do when Jesus tells parables. There's something here beyond, you know, a history lesson happening. These scenes have been a source of so much discussion and debate and contemplation for thousands of years. And a big question here is, why is it right for Moses to hit the rock to get water for thirsty people the first time, but it's so wrong to do it the second time that he's punished and forbidden from entering the promised land? I mean, it really seems it seems like a big overreaction. Well, there are tons of interesting theories, and one great theory is from an author named Tim Laniak, who this would require some geographic and geologic wisdom here. But the first time Moses hits the rock, he's in a place where the rock formations are granite, and you can't make water weep from granite. So that would be an obvious miracle. But the second time, based on where they were, the rocks there are limestone, which is a very porous rock, and water collects inside of it. So the second time when he hit it, that would just be an old shepherd's trick for watering your herds, where you take your stick and knock a calcium plug loose, and it's like tapping a keg. So instead of speaking to the rock, I don't know if you caught that, but this time he was told to speak, to command the rock, to speak to the rock, to make room for a miracle, which could increase trust and peace. He doesn't speak to it. He hits it, and he hits it twice, which communicates to the people that violence and severity are still solutions. Now, I think this idea could have some merit, but my attention is more drawn to the fact that the first time Moses hit the rock, it was 3 months into a journey with people who, very understandably, probably still thought of themselves as enslaved people. You could say they still thought and acted on the patterns of unfree people. They just understood down in their bones, after all those years of having been enslaved and dehumanized, that if you want something, you force it. That's what had been done to them. So as a symbol, hitting the rock the first time, it's like you just turn up the severity. You beat out of life what you want and what you need, because that, again, that's what was done to them. It makes sense. The second rock is a different group of people. It's the same issue, same need, but it's a very different mindset. The oppressed mind before understands the striking and the attacking and the force and the severity to accomplish goals. But the free mind, it speaks and it listens. It operates in the rhythms of peace and calm and trust. Moses got angry at angry people who wanted to go back to a familiar suck. So Moses goes with them mentally. He also goes backwards and he hits the rock twice. Moses was, in fact, what they needed originally, you know, to get a people from their terrible upbringing to that in-between finding yourself space. But Moses isn't what's going to get them to liberation, to transformation, to what was next. What got them here won't get them there. And I bet what got you here isn't what's going to get you there. And I'm not going to start bashing New Year's resolutions. I have some. I'm a sucker for clean restarts. And I'm fully aware a lot of you don't have them. That's fine, too. But But it's inescapable that we have in our collective consciousness this time of year, every year, but especially now, the sense that there are shifts taking place, that they're coming on every level. That 2025 is going to throw things at us societally, nationally, globally, but then personally. And we get to decide how we're going to engage it, the way that we always have or something different. I've heard several people in recent months say about politics and the election, I tried being kind and understanding, but no more of that. Time to get tough. I'm going to give them a taste of their own medicine. And I understand the anger and disappointment, but I'm concerned that some people who could go about this next season in a very different way, they're saying, just give me my stick. I'm going to go backward and try and force a preferred future with the mentality of the past. But more specifically to individuals, I've heard this a lot, and I just heard it again the other day. Somebody say that 2025 is the year I stop making excuses and I'm going to get into shape. I'm not going to eat this anymore. I'm not going to be a weakling. I'm not going to blah, 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 blah. And I genuinely hope that if that's what he wants, that it works. And I'll tell you, the gyms are hoping the same thing for him and a lot of us. But what's clear to me in intentions like that, resolutions like that, is they're rooted in disgust. They're rooted in a self-shaming. He sounded like he believed that what would make him something new and better was applying shame to himself. The same shame that had been aimed at him probably when he was really young that made him feel bad about himself in the first place. And plenty of people have health goals and relational goals and work goals and money goals, and those are good and important. It's important to have goals. But when the engine running them is self-shaming and disgust, a continued quest to reinvent ourselves, to hide the parts of us that need to be hidden in order for others to find us valuable or worthy of love and inclusion, that's not going to be good. That's not going to take you and I where we want to go, because it's probably the same energy we got blasted with in our early years, but now it's showing up disguised as a new stick and a new rock. It's trying to get to a new place using old patterns and stories and attitudes that you and I internalize from the past, but we tweak them. The unaccepting, the desperate, the anxious stories that we've told about ourselves for so long that we assume they're true just by virtue of having lived by these stories for so long. So consider how you're thinking of your goals for this year, if you have them. How many of them are, I'm going to hit the rock again, but I'm going to hit it harder, I'm going to hit it more times, more consistently, and I'm going to use a better stick? And then how many of us got to a point where we don't make resolutions anymore because it's like I've just given up. I've hit the rock so many different ways, it doesn't matter. I'm just going to settle for this side of the Jordan River because you know what? At least I'm not a Canaanite. I know these are complicated ideas. I don't mean to minimize everything to metaphor. And much as I'd like to, I can't just say, and here are all the solutions and right answers. What I'm hoping to do is offer a well-timed echo for intuitions you may already have, a signal flare, a light on your dashboard that reinforces, if it's time, and for very many of us it is, that the thing that needs prioritizing, the thing that needs kindness and awareness, the thing that needs healing, saving, transformation, is on your inside. And it's becoming, or is completely clear, that I have to open myself to it. I have to do this. We've known for thousands of years that there's religion that gives us myths and stories and rituals to give us a sense of belonging and community, security in the storm. But then beyond right belief, beyond the rehearsing the doctrines and this and doing all the sin management, beyond that, there's this way of freedom. And that is an inside out thing. It's wounds that we've had for so long that we think of them as natural parts of who we are. It's those wounds finally healing. And from that healing, the inner shift happens where our natural capacity for kindness, for being compassionate and honest, aware, strong, vulnerable, creative, loved and loving, it finally clicks into place like it never has before. Now, this moment is going to look a little different for everyone, but there's some commonalities. It's things like realizing the ways I have tried to matter to other people, it used to feel like it was going to work, but I am now starting to see that all it's done is highlight that nothing I do makes me feel like I actually matter. And for the first time, maybe with a profound grief or fear, I am realizing that swinging the stick at the rock harder and more times, it's not going to make me feel like I matter. The way I have tried to find validation by what I produce, how I make other people feel, it got me some results here and there, but I am coming to the point where I see that those transactions are not resolving my sense of invalidation. There's something inside that has to be done. The way I have tried to make sure other people understand me correctly, by correcting them, by being defensive, sometimes angry deflections. After all this time, I am realizing I have not made myself feel more known or more understood. I think I've made myself difficult to speak to. I think I've made a habit out of not being a great listener. The things I have worked to achieve that gave me immense pride, the thrill of accomplishment, I am now at this point in my life starting to sense that those accomplishments have expiration dates. I'm seeing that my fear of having a default state of deficiency, that I'm unworthy of respect, of love, of belonging, those fears demand I have to achieve a new fresh batch of successes every couple of days. The things that I have postponed because I have been waiting to get some stuff worked out first, I still haven't stepped into those things. Even though the stuff I wanted to get worked out, it just turned into new stuff to work out. I am realizing finally that the need to have everything just so, to feel perfectly ready, it's not to make sure that things go well, it's to make sure they never go at all. That way I can never be seen as a failure. There's a million of these moments where we finally see that what got us here, it's not going to get us there because I've seen and I can't unsee. And you know that you're seeing well when you also sense, I'm not going to be able to will this or judge this or shame this or hate it away, because those are just more sticks. Those aren't solutions. Those are part of what hold me back. They don't take me forward. And you feel a little lost at first. And the other commonality in these moments, these aha moments, where we see that the patterns and the consciousness that got me here aren't going to get me there. Another huge commonality I can point out is that it's rarely the result of simply feeling ready for like a new thing to begin. Generally speaking, it comes from something else finally coming to an end. For whatever reason, we are built in a way that our best ahas are found at the bottom of the shadow of the valley of death. It's loss that puts all this in motion. It's getting hurt where you had always been loved before. It's dashed hopes. It's coming to a period when you were sure God had told you it was a comma. It's shattered dreams and there's no chance of rebuilding. It's grief. I'm saying that the moment of realizing something inside needs tending to and prioritize because I cannot go any further on the previous avoidant and fearful mindset, on the shame that had been a prod to get me here, that generally occurs in the thing you and I put almost all of our energy into avoiding. And then we just can't avoid it anymore. It's treasure buried in a field that's full of thorns. It's like resurrection, really. I mean, you can't just skip to resurrection. Resurrection is what happens on the other side of death. That's the only way you get to it. Jesus put it this way in the Gospel of John. Very truly, I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single seed, a grain. But if it dies, that's when it bears much fruit. These shifts to inner work inside the heart that we always talk about God inhabiting, they seem to mostly require implosion and breaking for us to really open ourselves to them. Otherwise, we'd probably never choose them. We just, you know, pick out new sticks. And I'll say most of our church experiences have been so about staying focused on right belief, managing our shameful interiors with shame, that we're hardly equipped for what the mystics, the sages outside of mainstream religion have for eons been calling the dark night of the soul or ego death or hell on earth. We've been trained to believe anything less than happy, clappy Christians is bad faith. That's not the case. So no wonder so many of us have felt that we had to leave the church to heal. to become who we really are, to grow up? How can we do honest inner work in healing and transformation when somebody else has predetermined what that's allowed to look like? Because it's hard. It's messy. It's terrifying. It's not formulaic. It's not something captured with doctrine. And ultimately, it's not something that can be done for you. You may have noticed that when people talk about change, they bring up butterflies a lot. This idea that the metaphor of a caterpillar, you know, it steps into a little cocoon and then it flies out, transformed, better than ever. I want to remind you of the terrifying reality that God has created here. Butterflies don't make cocoons. There's a few moth species that make those. Butterflies don't make cocoons. They form a chrysalis, which is its own body. I mean, when the time is right, when the caterpillar cannot do caterpillar things anymore, the caterpillar reaches a crisis point and the chrysalis comes from inside of it. It's inside work. And the chrysalis is formed, and once that happens and it hardens, it releases these enzymes that liquefy the interior completely. It goes to complete goo inside, except for a few basic structures. And I hope you're listening, and it's breathing tubes. Only fundamental architecture and its ability to breathe are not completely dissolved. And this is when something called imaginal discs wake up. They've been there the whole time. They've been waiting. They have these codes within themselves, and they go to work at that point to work at making butterfly pieces. They were there all along, but they can't do their thing until everything else in the caterpillar's life has gone to literal crap. That's the moment. The thing the caterpillar could be forgiven for wanting to avoid, for being afraid of, that's when what was already inside is ready to be known and to throw on the lights and make what's next possible. There's no wing store for caterpillars to go to. There's no flight reward for correct belief. There's no butterfly costume that a caterpillar can put on to hide their caterpillar shame. There's not even a guarantee in the caterpillar's little brain where it can be made to understand things will work out. Trust the process. There's just it giving in to the moment when it happens, where what got him here will not get him anywhere else. And he is undone. Chaos and loss cannot be pretended away. It's not a fun process. It's not beautiful, really. Butterflies explain it to the other bugs as when they thought they were going to die. And yet I've never met a butterfly who wasn't really thankful that it finally happened and that they got all the way through it. You have every right to be happy. You deserve to be. And maybe you're looking at this next year as the year that you're committed to being happy no matter what it takes. Happier than you've ever been. Maybe you wouldn't put it this way. But I wonder if your commitment is built on, with all the hardship and disappointment that you've faced, you refusing to be anything but happy. And if so, I wonder if this isn't the moment to stop and really entertain the possibility that you're hoping to skip over a bunch of stuff and get to wings. Because you've not ever allowed your interior to transform and to heal. You've never really gone there. Again, you have every right to be happy, but our lives are so full of loss and pain that we've been conditioned to believe that those things make life bad because they work against happy. It's not cynical to say that there's a good chance that if some hard stuff hasn't already happened to you this previous year, it's probably coming in 2025. Life is full of beauty and joy, but it's also full of stuff that aren't that. There's no way around it. So if you're committed to being happy this year, will you stop and consider whether you got what got you here maybe isn't going to get you there? And open yourself to more deeply commit to maybe grieving things you've never allowed yourself to truly grieve. Will you commit to finding a constructive, honest way to express your anger after all these years of believing your anger is wrong? Will you commit to replacing the disgust put on you from your earliest years with words of excessive compassion and become sort of gently vigilant about the contempt that you use on yourself because you think that's what's going to force you to become more lovable? Will you commit to getting comfortable with discomfort? And I'm not talking about like the discomfort we feel at a gym. Get comfortable with the discomfort of saying what you mean and consider no longer erasing yourself for peace. Will you commit to reducing your apologies that erupt from your mouth when you say something true, but other people look like they don't seem like they like it? Commit to letting adults have their feelings. And I know that's scary, but you're beginning to see you abandon yourself and it doesn't make your life better. So will you love yourself enough to speak unapologetically because you know that you can be vulnerable and strong? Will you commit to saying more yeses because when you're honest, many of your no's, they help you avoid ending up in a spot where you can disappoint people. So say more yeses. Let the river carry you. Let other people help you and be with you because you now see your no has insulated you from a lot of life. But others of you, will you commit to saying more no's? Because if you're honest, it's your yeses that are a fear of disappointing others. But your countless yeses, they spread you so thin that you can see you're disappointing people that way too. And you're betraying yourself in the process. My friend Gareth says, it's our no, not our yes. That's how we show people they can trust us. And still others of you, will you commit to either yes or no? Because maybe you're recognizing now that all these years of replying, maybe, we'll see, I'll let you know, that's fear. Fear of the implications of commitment or direct speech. And you're starting to see that you use procrastination to protect yourself. You camouflage yourself with time. Will you commit to trusting and respecting yourself and others enough to say yes or no, and then stand behind it? And for so many of us, could we commit together to gently reducing our lifelong inner critics that we've come to see, that's not God, that's not the voice of the Holy Spirit, that's not our moral compass. It's an unsatisfied fault finder who always has something to say about what we're doing or not doing or who we are or who we failed to be. That voice maybe once made us feel protected from feeling like a failure or a bad person, but love is making her case that we can shrink that inner critic now and gradually replace his criticisms with kindness, curiosity, validation, the compassion we already give to other people. And listen, I know maybe no one in your family has ever done this work before. That's part of what makes all this kind of strange. Maybe they will. Maybe they're committed to their old stick. There's no need for you to feel guilty about you realizing you want to be more than older and righter this year. You want to start living from a profoundly healthy heart, especially as it's become way too obvious to ignore that what got you here isn't going to get you there. The there of being healed, to being honest and awakened from your inside out, and that you can bring that to yourself and to the world. You can't ignore it anymore. And so as we close, there's a legitimate couple of questions about like, well, what the heck do we do? And I just want to say again, we can't fix everything. That's not the goal. We have the whole year ahead of us. But for the immediate, just consider these few things. Get involved with this church. Volunteer. Look for groups to join. Why? Chiefly, and I'm being sincere here, that's your best shot, many of you, in this context, for connecting with some other people on the same path. Having some other people over the course of time that you can trade notes with about these things. It's super valuable. Plus, when you volunteer at Crosspoint, God loves you more. Another thing to consider, go to therapy. It's a really difficult thing to start. It's super uncomfortable if you've never done it. And if you quit and haven't gone back, man, it's so hard to start up again. I know that. I've done it several times. But let me tell you what a therapist is. A therapist is someone who got into their line of work because helping people makes sense to them. And you'll be paying them to help you. A therapist is an always for you human being that you might need to finally start learning how to recover and heal from junk you've carried around your whole life. A therapist is not a person with answers. They're people trained to give you the space to really let all God has put within you do its thing. And dudes especially, go to therapy. Stay with it. I'm happy to talk to you one-on-one more about that if you have questions or whatever. Oh, and don't worry about it being a Christian counselor. Christian isn't an adjective. It's a noun. Go to a good therapist. That's what matters. That's the adjective we're looking for. Another thing, read or listen to books. Read at least one book this year on trauma or self-compassion or shrinking the inner critic or anger or grief. We can help you, but if you just poke around online and see which books are evidence-based and review highly for being helpful, jump into one of those and jump into one with somebody else at the same time. Another thing, important as it is to hydrate and nourish yourself, slow down multiple times a day and breathe. Notice how your shoulders are stuck in a shrug and your breathing is shallow. That's your body pleading with you for peace. Don't just do something, stand there. Slow yourself and breathe. And watch as your nervous system over weeks and months starts to de-escalate, come off the fight or flight or freeze or fawn state that many of us stay in all day long. Slow down and breathe. And connected to this, schedule unavailability. Book yourself a few times a week, if only for 15 minutes, and then get an hour here and there when you can, where no one can reach you. You don't have your phone with you. There's no more data input. You're unavailable to the world and its lovely distractions, because if you love someone, you give them your attention. Now, I know you might need to ask somebody to watch the kids or cover this or that. That's good. That's okay. This is you showing up fully for you. One more for now. The Bible says everything comes down to love your neighbor as yourself. And I hope you find many ways to do that. It's our guiding light here at Crosspoint. Look forward to implementing that value at your side this year. And I hope you're seeing now how deeply important it is to love yourself as your neighbor. What I mean is to be for yourself what you already seek to be for others, that you would give yourself that same energy, that same work. It's important because loving you that way is what God is already doing. And I think it's a good idea for us to join in on that work. Love you as you love your neighbor. That's it for now. Peace to you inside and out. Amen.
If you would like to know more or get connected to Crosspoint, go to crosspoint.org. If you're in need of care or assistance, go to crosspoint.org/care. And welcome home.